Hello. You got your headphones in?
Hello.
Hello.
It's nice to see you've clapped and everything. We're all ready to go.
We're geared. We're up. We're ready and running.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm good, actually.
How was the keynote?
At the time of recording... You bugger. Okay, this is where we
have... Your laugh, you're doing a little sort of Daffy... No, not Daffy Duck. What's that? That's Woody Woodpecker.
Yeah, I actually think when I laugh like that, I feel like I'm one of the Ant Hill Mob. Do you know...
Oh, I don't know what the Ant Hill Mob is.
Okay, so Hanna-Barbera, they're the ones who like made Scooby-Doo and Captain Caveman.
Cartoons,
and, the TV cartoons, not the cartoons that were made as shorts for the cinema, which would be like the Warner Brothers, the Daffy Ducks, the Bugs Bunnies. Because remember that
I just forget that's what we saw before movies started. We used to watch those little short films.
Yeah, it still boggles my mind that we would have double features quite normally. There'd be the short beforehand, and then there'd be the
proper. Just the thing that boggles your mind, the fact that you'd be able to stay awake for the entire two films? This is a podcast in which two friends talk about the pleasures, absurdities, and imperfections of being human. I'm Simon Ellis.
And I'm Lee Miller. Welcome to Midlifing.
This is the thing, I couldn't. I was taken to see The Jungle Book. And I managed to stay awake through the Loch Ness Monster short beforehand.
Though.
I was pretty. I mean, it was released in 1968. So this is something as well that I think perhaps our younger listenership, if there are any, are maybe unaware of, is that there didn't used to be the amount of content coming out that there is now, because it is such an industrial complex of pumping out content across all these platforms. It used to be that they would re-release films quite regularly. So like, and I guess this is because this is in the days before home cinema. I mean, we were probably kids at the emergence of the VHS and the Betamax revolution. Again,
sure,
Betamax, for those... I was going to say Betamax for those of you who don't know what that is, but probably some of you don't know what VHS is. Shit.
Yeah, actually, if you don't know what VHS is and if you don't know what Betamax is, you're not really welcome to listen to this podcast.
Why are you listening to two
midlife? You can't to a podcast called Midlifing, for God's sake. Do something better with your lives.
Yeah.
Take up knitting, get a hobby, but don't listen to us, please.
Start recording a podcast called Midlifing for yourselves that's about, TikTok. Do you remember when that was a thing? Which I don't understand.
I remember, I read something recently about TikTok, which is, I know, I'll let you finish soon, but that the extraordinary time that's spent on it, but it's quite literally meaningless in the sense that, which is, you can, if you were to stop, and that none of the TikToks are ever remembered. None of them are remembered. You can forget, they're just instantly forgettable. And it was the sort of concentration of time and freewheelingness with memory, which was this person's point that they're trying to make. Go on, I don't want to get into TikTok.
I mean, there is something about the ubiquity of culture.
You cut that out. Please cut that out.
No. I was just going to say there's something about... I think you raise an interesting point, that there's something about the ubiquity of culture, about that TikTok sort of... It levels us across the globe but does a weird... Yeah, I think John Urry talks about it, the sociologist who was based at Lancaster University. I've definitely mentioned John Urry before. The idea of timeless time. Is a concept that he coined in relationship to being able to travel globally, and as a result, because you can travel globally, first of all, the sense of time that you spend traveling is sort of almost out of time, because it's not like the journeys of old, or even maybe the journeys that you take, because you like to travel overland.
That's right.
So you travel in
it might take two days.
So I don't think you would fall foul of the timeless time narrative, because you are living through your journey. You are experiencing your journey, as opposed to you're kind of in a stasis waiting for the journey to be completed, because it's so quick and you can cover such huge swathes of the land. But also there is an addendum to that, and I can't remember how he articulates it, but the sense that because you know you could get anywhere, you ultimately feel responsible for everywhere, and then you feel responsible for nowhere.
Oh, yes, because it's not, we can't scale up that way. We can't scale up experience that way. I mean, I think perhaps our response or our lack of responses to the climate emergency are pretty much like that, which is this thing which is just the scale of it is so enormous. What is it that I can possibly do, turn off a light?
Yeah, yeah. And also because it's entirely invisible to us, even though it's absolutely visible.
Yeah.
Because weather's this weird kind of, it's an incremental thing, isn't it?
Very.
It creeps up on you. A hot day creeps up on you. A wet day creeps up on you. Or the changing of those things. And the extremity of it creeps up on you. So you go out and it's a bit drizzly. And you're okay and you don't take a coat. And you just think, that's all right, I'm not going to be out for long. And then all of a sudden you're piss wet through because it became a deluge. And that's on the simple lived experience of being out in the rain. But when you extrapolate that to the, it's incalculable to know how to.
Yeah, last week I was talking a little bit about dancing and the workshop I was going to. And in fact, I'm at, no, I will be at, anyway, the workshop. The workshop is very much about being in the weather, and that, I forget the name of the poet, but the person who runs the workshop, her name's Helen Poyner, talks about weathering the weather, and I really like that turn of phrase, that sort of sense, and because you spend so long outside, your sensitivity to those things you've just described, you become really tuned to those shifts in breeze, shifts in temperature, shifts, all the things that you've just described, which are not climate, of course, they're weather.
Yeah. Helen Poyner, I think we are colleague cousins.
I don't know what that means.
No, I've just coined it as a term.
I'm happy that we are. I mean,
but
you
know, when you go to work in a new place, and
you are.
Your colleagues become like your siblings, because they're the people that you're in the building with at that time. Yeah, you're in that weird dysfunctional family with your colleagues, so they're like related to you, work related. But then there are those work relations who are no longer in the building, but they still talk about, who've just left. There's a guy who one of my friends. Look at that. Hey, Cam, if you're listening. Cam, one of my work friends, or friends. I don't know. I'll let him decide.
Work works.
He went to a stag do to a guy for a guy called Cyril, who used to work, and everybody was like, "Oh, give my love to Cyril." And I was like, "Who's Cyril?" And I was like, "Oh, he's a work cousin. He's somebody who I'm sort of related to, but I'm not, because I hear the name and I know, I know stories about him.
Yes,
but he's not somebody I have a relationship to. I mean, that doesn't really work, because obviously you do know your cousins. But that sense, I think Helen Poyner was a work cousin of mine.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's wouldn't surprise me at all. But weathering the weather. I can't remember how we got on to. You were talking about timeless time, about TikTok.
We started with cartoons. And I was going to say something about you. You were laughing at my laugh. That was last week. You were laughing at my laugh, and you said Woody Woodpecker. And I said I thought I sounded more like one of the Ant Hill Mob, and I was saying that. Did you ever find yourself watching Penelope Pitstop?
Yes, although I'm struggling to conjure up an image of Penelope Pitstop.
So she was very tall and thin, and she had pointy feet, and she wore a crash helmet, and she wore pink, and she had like a yellow scarf at her neck, I think. And she would run in a particular way where she would like run, lift her legs up and do the splits. And then, and so she'd just like jump and do the splits. And obviously in Hanna-Barbera cartoons, the backgrounds are the things that move, not the, the actual characters. And her uncle, or her, maybe not her uncle, but somebody who had a relation to her, was trying to get her family fortune because she was an orphan. And he would be, he took on an alter ego. He was the Hooded Claw. He would always try to get her. And he'd be like, I'll get you next time, Penelope Pitstop. But he would set lots of traps for her. And she had this, this is, I'm getting there, I promise. She had this like gaggle of small men. I'm not sure that we could watch this cartoon anymore. She had this gaggle of small men who drove in a like an old sort of 1920s car. And they looked like little tiny 1920s gangsters, and I think they maybe were, but one of them would go, Penelope's gonna die, and he would laugh about the fact that Penelope was going to die. And when I laugh, I hear him go, and I often will laugh at home, and Bob and I will say at the same time, Penelope's gonna die.
There we go. Really can't believe there hasn't been a reboot of Penelope Pitstop. By the way, as you're talking, of course, I was looking up the, I was looking up an image because yes, it's very clear, and I remember the dastardly, either kind of wacky races.
Yes, that's it. Because she was in. Oh, that's the other thing. For those, I don't believe I'm talking about this, but she had her own show, but she also would turn up in
the perils of
Penelope Pitstop, and she would also turn up in the wacky races. And the wacky races had Dastardly and Muttley. It had, I think it might have had Boris and Natasha. Exactly. Penelope's gonna die.
So just to swing straight back to any young listeners who didn't know what Betamax is, I'm sure you've turned off by now anyway, because what the hell is going on in this episode of Midlifing?
Penelope's gonna die.
Show title. Perfect show title.
Oh.
So did you, that's all.
That's all? That's all preamble.
Yeah, that's preamble. Why, hang on, why were you talking about
Penelope Pitstop?
No, why were you talking about, because your laugh sounded like that. That's all, this is all from just what your laugh sounded like.
It was all literally because we started, I laughed. Because I was laughing. this is an episode I can already feel Susan reaching for her phone to switch it off.
Or just dry retching, basically. Or dry reaching, as I like to
leave it. Penelope's going to die. Susan's going to switch off. Oh, I'm sorry, Susan.
Should we keep on with Penelope?
No, I think we can draw a veil over Penelope, because I don't think there's that much more. Oh, I don't know. Now I could start to talk about Velma, and we could start to talk about Fred, and we could go deep into the Hanna-Barbera back catalogue. We could talk about the monsters, but no, well, let's not.
You could, because I would.
Oh, you would have been practicing. You would have been practicing tennis while I was watching all of these things.
Exactly. My brother Ian, who was an exceptionally good cyclist in his teenage years, and he basically taught me by role modeling what it is to be disciplined and to be fully committed to training. If I was watching TV when he came home from school or whatever, he would tease me mercilessly about just sitting there doing nothing. He was really like, if you're serious about tennis, like he was really. So he used to do these incredible long rides, and he used to describe it as basically cycling away from rain clouds. So he'd just bike over all the Wairarapa, which is, you know, where Masterton's, the province where Masterton is in New Zealand, and he would just be, as he described it, avoiding rain clouds. And the other thing that happened, I remember he And so he also has got his head down a long time, right? So these are big open roads where he just has his head down, just working, working, working. It's a very particular kind of mindset, I think, a particular kind of personality to deal with that kind of time in a saddle and on a bike saddle, and also which is different from the kind of swimming thing, which is looking at a black line going up and down. That's an intense kind of boredom that I think swimmers deal with. But anyway, he was cycling one day and looked up and saw a car ahead, parked. It's a long way ahead. And then put his head back down and misjudged the distance between him and the parked car and just went straight into the back of it at whatever it was. It would have been 40 kilometres an hour, 30 kilometres an hour. Yeah, his teeth were red. Yeah, not great. Not great at all.
You see, now I never lost my teeth watching Penelope Pit Stop, so all in all...
Much safer endeavour.
Yeah. And also it gives me something to talk about on a podcast, because otherwise I'd be saying, like, so I pushed one foot down and then I pushed the other foot down.
Yeah, exactly. You talk about Penelope Pit Stop and I'm... And one, yeah.
And the other. Yeah. I'm saying that as if I'm not in deep, deep awe of that kind of commitment.
He was an incredibly extraordinary athlete. He really was so strong.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, we decided that I was the very definition of a flippity gibbet, and
they don't work together, do they?
No, I'm too flighty. I'm too easily distracted and off with the fairies, as I was often told.
We were in. We had this. There was a gym that opened up in Masterton, because this is before gyms really existed. You know, there used to be the YMCA, of course, but that wasn't really a gymnasium in the sense of, you know, with weights and that kind of thing. And we got memberships, and I would have been. I must have been 12. And, you know, given programs, which must have been hilarious for the people who were giving the programs. And I have no idea how well qualified they were. Ian will remember, and maybe Susan remembers better than I do. But Ian was, he was 15, and he was just he was starting to get big. And he was really a sprinter. He was best. He was wanting to be a sprinter, but he had this kind of mixture of aerobic and anaerobic strengths, which doesn't matter. But he was doing doing squats. And I remember he had all the weights on these squats. And when he did squats, you know, quite literally the bar would bend. And people would stop and watch him do squats. That's how, and he was just 15, maybe he was 16 by that time. Very, very, very strong he was. But he seemed to be uncomplaining. You know, this is basically a kind of sense of awe and feeling inspired, and how I felt inspired by watching him as I was growing up, and just how disciplined and committed he was. And clearly those two things they meant something to me then, as they do now, I think.
It's so alien listening to you talk like this. Not only because I lack discipline. That's not fair.
Really?
I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I said that. My discipline is different. Yeah, how about that? And also, maybe I came to it later in a different sort of a way.
But it's alien about thinking about it as a child, though?
That's it. It's alien thinking about it as a child, but it's not just that. It's also the alienness of seeing somebody who you share DNA with doing something. And I just, my childhood is...
Oh, you mean being by yourself?
Vast, vast stretches of time being entirely by myself. I mean, utterly alone. And to be very clear, not at all lonely. I lived on a street with lots of kids, and I would choose my own company a lot of the time over theirs. And I would wander away. And this is, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, where you could wander away and disappear for 12 hours and nobody was worried, you know.
Yes, our mum, I think maybe I've told you this, had a gong.
Yeah, you did. Yeah,
and she used to just whack the gong. And that was the call for us to come back into the house, dinner time.
In the summer, I had to be home by the time the streetlights came on.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh no, I have very strong memories of coming back in the dark. So anyway, it does make me think, though, that being an only child, you know, and it's a topic. It variously, I don't think that we've ever talk directly about it. It's something that's come up because of that very stark difference between, in my case, being the youngest of four, and your case being the youngest and oldest of one.
Yeah.
And but I've been thinking a lot lately about the way in which, as we get older, and I imagine it probably happens around the time we leave home, more or less, if you're going to university, that kind of time. But how easy it is to start taking family for granted. And because the kind of energy that gets put into siblings and being with family, and I'm wondering if that's different for you because of being an only child, but that so many of the things I think about, that the issues or the problems that have gone on within my family, don't have to labor the point, but the kinds of, are mostly about absence, in the sense they're mostly about things that have grown as a consequence of absence, that have been fed by not having time together, and for good reasons. We haven't been, it's not like we pursued a life apart.
Yeah,
but you moved in the other side of the world.
Exactly. That's a big cue, isn't it? That if you're on the other side, in another hemisphere, it's kind of hard to spend time together.
But I think my point, exactly. And I think my point is that it's easy to take family for granted in a way that we don't take friends for granted. Or that's a thought, put it that way, or a proposal, or an offer.
I don't know. I feel singularly unqualified to be able to have a conversation about this, because I have my parents, and I have more cousins than you can poke a stick at, but they're cousins, you know. I grew up alongside of them, but not with them. And I'm the only child in my family.
So cousins have brothers or sisters.
Exactly. So I would come in and witness these sibling dynamics that I just didn't understand. And I couldn't understand. If I think about Mark and Neil, who are the closest in age to me. So Neil is maybe 2 years older than me. Neil's 2 or 3 years older. Mark will be 4 or 5 years older.
Yeah. You were still the youngest. And when you're nine and you're only seven, or they're nine, 11 and 13, those are big differences at that age. Yeah.
It was, I remember watching Mark become more and more alien to me quite quickly.
Hang on, Mark was the...
Mark was the oldest.
Yep. So 4 years older.
Yeah, I was just like, I sort of didn't get him anyway. And then he just got weirder and weirder. And I remember sitting on the bonnet of his car, his dad's car, Uncle Brian's car, outside the house. And for some reason we were sent outside. It was the 70s. Who knows why we were sent outside? We're probably smoking. No, that wouldn't make you send a kid outside, would it? They probably just... Anyway, we were outside and we were sitting on the bonnet of the car. It was a hot day. And he would have been in secondary school by then. And I guess I would have been seven or eight. And
so he was just in secondary school. Just still a pipsqueak.
Oh, tiny, just a baby, but still like this alien creature. And I don't remember Neil being around, but I remember Mark being, well, obviously. So Mark was there, and somebody he went to school with walked past and went, "Hey up, Miller." And I was struck by how grown up that was. It was like,
"Hey up."
The A up bit wasn't grown up. That was just Northern. I was struck by, and he might have even said all right rather than A up, but I think he probably would have said all right. Or he actually would have said "Ari," actually.
All right.
In fact, he would have said "Ari." There we go. It's taking me a while to get the idiom back, because it's such a long time since I've lived in that part of the world.
You're a true blue Southerner now, though, aren't you?
It's funny. I can hear it in my vowel sounds. I'm still very much Northern when I say, like, book. Yeah.
Even the word vowel, it came out in the word vowel. But yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, I don't say but. It still has an
but
to, rather than a. It's more at the back of the throat rather than the. But. There we go. I just corrected. Sometimes I was talking to somebody the other day, and I for some reason, I don't know what happened, I rounded out a vowel sound. I think it was a cast rather than a cast. It was that kind of, it was that noise, it was an A noise, and I just was like, what the fuck just happened in my mouth? That was odd. It was really, really odd, and it was an entirely unconscious thing. And I don't know if I was echoing back the way they sounded, but I don't think I was. It was just odd.
That does those things are, you know. I think last week we were talking about sort of being uber social animals, and those things are so, you know, they're very strong, aren't they? The way in which we signal being in and signal being out.
Yeah.
And, you know, how the language we use, I mean, you think teenagers, that's why teenagers construct languages, the way they construct languages is about being in.
I'm remembering this boy going, Reet Miller, and just being struck by how alien this thing that I knew was part of me was suddenly being, because I knew he was my dad's brother's son, so I knew that we were related, and I understand that we were connected, and he'd been in my life since I was born. I remember, you know, that this we would see him relatively regularly. But man alive, it made him super alien. And because I didn't see him growing, I would just get snapshots in the same way that he would get snapshots. It was just like, it was odd. So I'm so unqualified to think about what impact distance has on family. I only understand my family, my extended family, through distance.
What I didn't understand about that story was what was striking about that exchange between the guy that was at school. What was it that was the hook with that and your experience of being by yourself?
I felt very, very excluded from the exchange.
Oh, I see.
I felt so outside of it, and I didn't understand the social dynamics. I didn't understand who Mark was in that moment. I didn't understand the relationality between him and this person. I didn't understand being called by your last name. It felt
so something
weird.
Gotcha.
Everything about it was just like, what the fuck is this?
Mm.
Obviously, I didn't think, what the fuck is this? I was 7. I probably thought, ooh, this is scary. And I would have thought it was scary because I was probably
a bit nervous.
I was a timid. I guess timid. I was a timid kid.